The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
The order is first you put on the tallit and then you put on the tefillin. Where we talked about yesterday how tzitzit represent the context. They don't just represent. Again, it's not a religion of symbolism. That's the worst thing someone could do to Judaism, is tell you this symbolizes that and that symbolizes this. Because more than symbolization, we believe that these acts are the objectification of divine will. Right? And that when someone does this, they are plugging into divine will. So, these are really fine-tuning instruments that help us tune into ourselves and ultimately God. And those are not the same. So the question is, what is tefillin? What is tefillin all about? Now, I think one very important fact you should know about tefillin, something that I can only help you appreciate through my own personal experience, is when I was traveling from, again, the United States to Canada, we had to put our baggage through an X-ray machine. And there was a very large black woman operating the machine, and she asked me to open up my bag before I put it through, and she saw my tefillin. Right? And she said, "What's that?" So I said, "It's tefillin." She says, "Well, if it's tefillin, you better not put it through the X-ray machine because it'll get exposed." So you should just know that some opinions hold that your tefillin get exposed. But if you... Right, just don't fill your cameras with it. Okay. So what is tefillin? Right, tefillin. We have the hand tefillin, and we have the head tefillin. We're going to go on a field trip today to see the process of how they're made, and we're trying to organize a field trip to a factory where they're made. These are the head tefillin. How can I know these are the head tefillin? Because they have a shin on the side. Right? They have a shin on the side, and if you look very carefully, they have four compartments. Right, if you look very, very carefully, right now you can only see four lines. Right? Looks like just four lines. That's not lines. It's actually separate compartments. Right? Separate compartments. The tefillin are made out of leather, and it's made out of one piece of leather. That means that this entire box has been molded out of one piece of leather. Right? One piece of leather. By taking the leather and draping it over some kind of bar, they take this leather and they bend it and they stretch it, and with the head to fill in, it'll look like that. As they mold it and bend it and shape it into a perfect square. So that's what this is. Right. These four compartments are actually complete compartments. And this has been pressed so completely that it looks just like lines. But it's not lines. Right? It's four separate compartments. In these compartments are various portions in the Torah that speak about tefillin, which are four. Four passages in the Torah that speak about tefillin. And these are the hand tefillin. The hand tefillin or the arm tefillin go on the arm, and they go on the biceps, right? They'll go right over here, okay? The lower part of the muscle over here. And it inclines towards your heart, just gently, not over here, right? Not over here. Just gently incline towards the heart when you put your hand down, right? It would be over there, right? Close to your heart. And this is actually one compartment with the very same passages
of the Torah of the head tefillin, however, written on one parchment. Okay? One parchment, and here you've got it on four parchments. They are folded up, tied with a special kind of thread, and placed inside the compartment. And here is one parchment rolled up and placed inside. Okay? Now, tefillin can run various prices. They sell plastic ones that don't cost much at all because they're no good. But then there are those that are real, and they could run anywhere between $200 to, I would venture, a couple thousand dollars. Right? It's a piece of art. It is craftsmanship, and there is various degrees of what makes tefillin more expensive and more beautiful, right? More significant. One, for instance, is the type of leather you're using. Right? Is it thick or is it thin? Now, what's the difference if it's thick or thin? The difference is, what happens if your tefillin drops? Right? If your tefillin drops, chances are very good that the corner of the tefillin will get damaged. If it is made out of thin leather, then they cannot be fixed. Right? If it's made out of thick leather, then they can file it down and reshape the corner. Okay, so that's one practical reason.
Why does it have to be four corners?
Why does it have to be four corners? Tefillin are just mystical. There's not too much rational about it. We will develop as much rational appreciation for their meaning for us. But in the final analysis, they have to be, the best tefillin are perfectly square. And you're talking about an incredible amount of time and precision to create perfectly square. Now you can see these tefillin, the corners are already starting to round off. Right? These are not the most expensive tefillin in the world.
If they're rounded off, does that mean it's, they're possible?
If they get really round, like this isn't too round yet, but if they really got very round, yeah, it could be puzzle. It could be no good at a certain point. So why you got to be very, very careful with them. Okay, so there's various types of, grades of leather and things like that. Now the shin over here is pulled out of the leather. Now, with tweezers, they are pulling out, they are molding again the leather, creating a shin as it comes out of the leather. And this is really an art. You have to learn how to do this. It takes a great amount of time, concentration. Now, first we put on the arm tefillin before we finish the bracha. As we first make the bracha, and as we're finishing the bracha, we tighten the arm tefillin around the arm, and then we go around the arm seven times. Right? Wrap it around the arm seven times. And then just wrap it around your hand so that you can continue on to put your head tefillin. And your head tefillin, pretty big head this one. But the head tefillin, this thing is going all over my head. The head tefillin, the box must not go below your hairline or what was once your hairline. And it should not go past where a baby's head is soft, which is around the center over there. If you've ever felt the baby's head, it's a place where the skull is not yet hardened. Right? And then this back knot just goes underneath, I don't know what you would officially call that, but just where the head is rounding. You have a name for that? The nape of the neck. Everyone know where your napes are? Okay. Well, that's where you put it. Okay. And the straps must go one over here and one over here. Right? Not behind you, but in front of you. Okay. If, God forbid, your tefillin fell on the ground, generally we fast for the day. So don't drop your tefillin. Okay.
What if your leather straps touch the ground or something like that?
Oh, that's okay. I mean, you don't want to do that, but if it does happen, that's not a serious problem. Okay. By the way, one of the next projects in art is you're going to be drawing tefillin. What are the tefillin all about? What they're all about, I couldn't tell you. But what they're a little bit about That we could touch on. First of all, there's a very interesting piece in the Talmud that says that a servant who is wearing tefillin in front of their master must be freed already. In other words, if you see a person who was once a servant or a slave, right, in those days you had Jews that sold themselves as slaves, they couldn't make a living, right? So the best thing for them to do was to sell themselves as a slave at the time and be taken care of by a master. It's not the ideal of Judaism, but it is a situation that is recognized. Well, if you see this fellow who was once a slave putting on tefillin, then you know that they must be freed. Right? Must be that they got their parole papers, whatever, they're freed. So we see that the idea of tefillin is connected to the idea of freedom. Right? The idea of freedom. Now what does that mean? When I'm putting on my hand tefillin, I am basically saying that I dedicate my physical powers, my manual skills to Hashem, to God, to the revelation of God. Which, of course, what does that mean? It means involving myself in actions of ethics, of morality, and of mitzvah. Not all mitzvot have anything to do with morality. I mean, in the ultimate end, they have a great amount to do with reality, with morality. Because the mitzvot, whether they are between man and man, and man and God, they are crucial to creating a context and a ground for there to be a world of morality. Because if there is no relation between man and God, then there is no ground upon which to build a world of relation between man and man. That's why we see the mitzvah between man and God not as something separate, right? But ultimately the foundation upon which is built the mitzvahs between man and man. Right? So not all the mitzvahs are moral, but in the final analysis, all the mitzvahs contribute to a ground upon which to build a moral world. But that still doesn't mean that that's the only meaning of the mitzvot. Does the mitzvot have greater meaning in terms of relation with God? In terms of the sense of meaning that one gains in terms of understanding I as an individual and part of the expression of a great master. So when you're putting on your tefillin, you are dedicating your actions. You are binding yourself up with God again. And that's true freedom. Because freedom, I'm sure you're familiar with the Erich Fromm idea, freedom from and freedom to. There are different kinds of freedom. There's freedom from that which is an obstacle to me being who I am. Right? I am a servant to you. When a person's a slave and they have a master, it means my life is spent in fulfilling who you are, not who I am. Right? So freedom from such a master is you run out of the guy's house and you take off. But does that mean that you are free to be who you are? You are free from the obstacle which restricts your ability to be who you are, true to yourself. But that doesn't mean you know how to be true to yourself, right? Who says we know how to be true to ourselves? There are people who are enslaved to their parents because their parents convinced them that you have to be a businessman. And the child always felt suppressed, that I'm not being me. I'm not free to be who I am. I've somehow got my parents and they have convinced me that I've got to be who they are. So you run out of the house, right, take off, and you find yourself, you know, in some college in the North Pole. UNP, University of North Pole. Right? Anything to get away from your parents. But does that mean you now know who you are? What it means to be free. So who am I? I don't know who I am. Right? I know who I'm not. I don't know who I am. So there's freedom from that force that is making me into something I'm not. But that doesn't mean I have the freedom to be who I am. That's the difference between getting out of Egypt and going to Sinai. Right. Getting out of Egypt was freedom from the suppression and the oppression of Egypt. But does that mean I know what it means to be who I am? Have I succeeded in finding a lifestyle that truly expresses my unique character and potential? That's freedom too. That's what happens at Sinai. That's what happens at Sinai. I would say that, you know, there's a lot of therapy groups in the States, various weekends, you know, that help you. But those weekends are generally freedom from weekends. These are weekends based on how to get out of Egypt. You know, how to get out of yourself, how to get out of your own narrowness, how to get out of your inhibitions. But that doesn't mean that you know who you are and know how to direct it. You know how to get out, but you don't know where to go. So the tefillin represent a fundamental idea in Judaism that a person who is free is a person who's involved in Torah. So it says in the Talmud. Ein ben charin ela misho sek b'Torah. There's no such thing as a free person, referring to Jews, that unless they are involved in Torah. Why? Because we understand that Torah restores to the human being their ultimate potential, which is to be an image of God. And that the service of God is actually self-fulfilling. To help the Word understand how it should serve the theme of the book is actually the Word's own way to freedom, to be who the Word truly is. So that the tefillin on one end seems like I'm binding myself up, I'm subserviating myself to God. And in general circles, service means slavery. Service means slavery. But it's not true. Because to understand how I serve the greater whole is actually how I discover my unique identity. And it's from there I derive my unique identity. See, very often people think service is slavery, it's suppression. Well, the first thing they have to realize, right, is to serve or not to serve is not the question. Because everybody's serving. Right? And in the infamous words of a Jewish sage, Bob Dylan, right? You're going to have to serve somebody. Right? Everybody's going to have to serve somebody. Right? In some situation, you're always serving. Whether it's serving your family, whether it's serving the community, whether it's serving the country, we naturally seek to serve. Because service is the freedom of who I can be. Because the natural tendency of a word is to serve the paragraph, to serve the theme, to serve the book, to serve the author. In the author's manifestation, it's natural to serve. Like you think you're not going to serve, not everybody's serving. That's an illusion to think that I'm not. I'm free. Right? The true meaning of freedom for human being is the freedom to serve that which is the most self-fulfilling. To serve my country is to serve a servant. Because who is my country serving? The universe. Well, what's the universe serving? Right? The ultimate reality, Hashem. So service is fundamental. Everybody serving. But certain situations of service is self-betrayal, self-destructive, and certain types of service is actually the way of self-fulfillment. The Jewish people believe serving God restores to the human being their ultimate potential to be a living manifestation of God. So the tefillin again expressed that idea of freedom. And it says in the pasuk, right, that you'll put these tefillin on your head and you'll remember that I took you out of Egypt. What one got to do with the other? Because the tefillin, again, represent to me and teaches me what it means to be free. Free to be in a relationship with God. And in that relationship is where I find my true self. Because it's only in relationships that you're going to find yourself. Nowhere else. Only in relationships do we find ourselves. Certain relationships are not productive to who we are. Certain relationships are. Certain relationships you'll be with, you'll feel after a while, I'm not being me when I'm around this person. Right? They're not drawing out of me, the situation is not drawing out of me the true me. And certain people you're with, you say, ha, these are the kind of people that I think I should be with. Because within the context of that relationship, the true me merges. Well, the Jewish people believe the ultimate relationship upon which all other relationships must be built is a relationship with God. And it's in that relationship the true me comes out. I am free. So the tefillin goes even beyond simply dedicating my physical activities to the expression of God. But it is actually entering of relationship with God, because as we put on the finger tefillin, when we wrap it around our finger, spelling or producing a letter shin on our hands, which we'll talk about in a second, we say, I betroth myself to you. Ve'erastich li le'olam. It's actually, to a certain extent, like a wedding ceremony. Well, I'm betrothing myself to God.
So what are you
saying again? Ve'erastich li le'olam. I betroth you unto me forever. I betroth you unto me through justice, through kindness. That's how you betroth yourself to God. Through the fulfillment of responsibilities, that's how you betroth yourself to anybody. Right? A relationship where the spouse or the supposed spouse is not fulfilling the responsibilities, then it doesn't matter how many times they tell you they love you. This is not a relationship. This is not a relationship. So, the tefillin is the entering into the context of relationship with God. But in the unique person that I am. The tzitzit sets up the idea of the context. Right? That I need a context. I must connect myself. The tefillin are connected to neshama. Right, we said that the talit and the tzitzit are connected to yachid and chaya, the all-encompassing light, the light of context. I draw my personal definition from the context where in which I serve. But the tefillin is connected to neshama, which we talked about, the special me, my ideal. And it's as if almost plugging myself in, almost as if these look like plugs. And it's like plugging myself into the talit. Right. I'm plugging myself into the talit in terms of my unique me. I mean, the tefillin is like wrapped around my very arm. It's not like this general encompassing, loose-fitting garment. We're talking about a very specific, it's really completely connected to me as I relate myself to the greater context. Okay? So that's the arm tefillin. Now, the head tefillin, before we finish the arm tefillin with the hands, We then put on the head tefillin. And of course, what am I saying then? I dedicate all my intellectual faculties to my relationship with God, to the revelation of God in the world. I serve my intellectual faculties to God. It's then that my intellectual faculties will be free to perform according to the true essence. Only then. Okay. But now I want to go a little deeper into the structure of the tefillin. Actually, just one more idea. It's interesting to note that first we put on the arm tefillin, and then we put on the head tefillin, and then we finish the arm tefillin. And what we're writing on our bodies, which is pretty heavy duty, we're writing on our bodies the name Shin Dalid Yud, which is one of the names of God, which we will be exploring in this very Chumash class. When God says to Abraham, my name is Kael Shakai, and I never told anybody that name, right? This is a new revelation for Abraham to know the name of God, that particular name of God, the Shin, the Dalet, the Yud, right? Now, just at its simple level, recognize that this is really way out. The Jewish people are writing the name of God on their body. How so? Well, first of all, you have a shin over here, right? Then you have over here a knot that looks like a dalet, right? And then you have over here a knot that looks like a yud. Okay? A yud. So too, when you're putting on the arm, you are actually, the way you wrap the tefillin on your hand, it will look like a shin, and over here on your finger, it will look like a dalet. So you got the shin, dalet, and again the yud. Okay? Or the shin, dalet, yud. And you got this name of God written on your body. Okay? Written on your body. Now what that name means, we will wait for the Chumash class, because the tefillin is a direct expression of covenant with God. And only when we understand what covenant is, can we really then understand what tefillin are within that context. Anyways, but why do we put the arm tefillin, then the head tefillin, then back to the hand? Because more than the mind directs action, action directs mind. Fundamental principle in Judaism. It's a little bit of a behavioral psychology that your behavior influences the way you think. Can you control what you think? It's very hard. Right. If you just take a couple minutes to kind of like watch your mind, you will see that it is just full of images. They're just coming all the time. The mind without end is just producing images, images. It's very hard. It's very hard to control your mind. As I once mentioned to you, that story about a guru. A fellow comes to the guru and he says, I'd like some advice and enlightenment, direction and meditation. And the guru said, no problem. All I can tell you is whenever you meditate, never, I mean never see monkeys. I've never seen monkeys meditating. Said, well, that's good. Next day, sure enough, sits down to meditate and there's this big monkey. So I don't believe it. Everything, and the more he tried to get rid of that monkey, the more monkeys that would come in his head. I said, I don't want to think about this monkey. The more you say you don't want to think about the monkey, you just did think about the monkey. Right? When he went back to the guru, he said, I don't believe it. I can't do it. I don't know what's going on. I'm seeing monkeys all the time now. What should I do? The master said, the next time you see the monkey, just look in the face. And you'll see it go away by itself. The whole time he's trying to get the monkey out of his head. So just accept it. Look it in the face. It'll just go away by itself. It's very hard. How do you control your mind? Right? How do you control your mind? Control what you're thinking, what you're not thinking. I'm sure all of us have experienced thinking such bad thoughts. You say, how can I think that about that person? Right? Our minds just come up. How do we control our minds? It's through our actions. That's how Jews always understood. More than the mind directs the actions direct the mind. And action has profound effects on the way we think. And this is a general principle with all mitzvot. They did an experiment with children. They had a group of children drawing for a week or 2 weeks with just black pencils. Another group of children drawing with red pencils. To see if just, you know, the difference in color makes a difference. And they definitely found that it did. Really made a difference in the kids' life. And I don't know the exact reactions. They saw red all the time. I don't really know. But it created a difference in the way they were thinking. And I'm sure everyone's a little familiar with graphology. Graphology, in terms of, you know, the art or science of handwriting analysis. And now there is therapies based on changing your handwriting. Changing your handwriting. Which is, you know, just crossing your T's. Being careful. You know, some people, they cross their T's over here. Everyone's looking at their handwriting. What does that mean? Some people dot their I's on the next word. What? Seen it work, changing a person's handwriting. Some people have a very strong incline to the left. Some people have a very strong incline to the right. Some people have very high T's. Right? Some people have very low fat G's. It's already becoming a science. In Israel, they really hold of it. Changing your handwriting. It seems so silly. It seems so small. Right? What's the difference if I, you know, put the T this way or that way? Does it make a difference? Right? Well, yes, it makes a profound difference for people. They're finding it to work. Right? So the same thing with the details of mitzvot. People say, what's the difference? Well, if you had the master genius psychologist, Moshe, the vehicle for the capital P psychologists of the universe, maybe you'd be more ready to appreciate there might very well be a difference. Right? In details. How you do things meticulously will make a difference. Okay?
What kind of difference?
I don't think we could ever define the difference in a way that words could offer. Right? But I think it's a very subtle difference in terms of people's sensitivities. And relationship to God, and relationship to people. So, that's the tefillin. But now I want to talk about the structure of the tefillin themselves. Very interesting. In particular, I'm going to talk about the head tefillin. Because the truth is that the head tefillin correlates completely to the intellectual process. Right? The intellectual process is so understood by Kabbalah. Now, we talked about will, goal, plan, principles of organization, right? Well, that all works because that's the basic sefirot scheme, the attributes. And it goes like this. There's will. And will is called crown. Will is the crown of the human being. Born out of will is intellect, and then emotions. And of course, the Jews believe that it is the head that should direct the heart and the actions, but of course, the actions first direct the head. But ultimately, this should be the crown of the human being, unlike an animal where this and the lower parts are on the same level. A human being stands vertical. Right? There is a hierarchy. And in terms of our structure, the structure suggests a certain hierarchy in the way we work. Okay? Animals, it's all on the same level. Right? The guts, which is your intuitive, right, which is connected to more the intuitive sexual desires, right, is at the same level of the emotions, which is the same levels of the mind for the animal, to a certain extent. Being that we stand erect, right, this is the crown, and it is here that we move it down as we conquer, right, in an uplifting way, of course, not in a suppressive way, but we conquer the rest of our beings. So this is the crown, and everything emerges out of will. Remember, your body structure will accord itself to your spiritual structure. So if there's an element within us that is demonstrating that we still have not transcended animal level, and that certain parts of our body are still more appropriate to animals, then I would only say, well, that's our problem. In other words, we haven't reached that level. But no one's had a chance to examine the hip of Moses or of any great tzaddik. So, I have no problems with my hip. I'm sure what they'll find. But in terms of Moses' hip, I think he was a hip guy. Okay? So, I really don't know. But the will, right? The will is the crown and it's the root of the human being. It's from there we plug into everything. Important to know, because what is the essence? You know, certain philosophers believe that the essence of life is reason. Like, what's it all made of? Reason. Mind. Right? And based on these type of philosophies, there's no free choice. Because everything's a function of mind. And the ignorant person is the person that makes mistakes. Right? And it's not like a question of free choice, it's just a question of knowledge. Right? But for the Jewish people, no. The foundation of living is will. Right? It's what you want. And everything else emerges and unfolds from the will. Right? Wisdom is not before will. Wisdom comes after will. Okay? What comes out of the will is what we call right brain, wisdom, or chachma, and left brain, bina, which is loosely translated understanding, but that's really, it's not even correct. But for now, that's what they call it, so why not use it? Okay? And what happens is, left brain and right brain is more an abstract, whole, experiential understanding. It's what we talked about in terms of goal, right? Your goal is security. You want something. What do you want? You want? Coming down? Right brain? I want security. Now what's security? That's still very abstract. So you have to create in your left brain an image, an articulated formula of what security means for you in this situation. So right brain is the goal. Bina is the plan. The plan always reflects the goal. Right, in a more articulate form. Okay? But that's not enough. Because what then happens is what we call dot, knowledge. And knowledge is the unification of right brain and left brain. It's where they would meet over here in the back. In terms of dot performs two functions. Dot is the unification of right brain and left brain, and the conversion of mind into the emotional forces that then direct action. Right? Because what's going to happen after this is that the emotional levels, which belongs to the values, the principles of organization, but then you get down to the emotional level. And dot, what happens is, in the scheme of the Sefirot, we only count 10. It's very interesting in the Sefer Yetzirah, in the Book of Formation, it says 10, not 9. 10 and not 11. Great. If it says 10, it says 10. Why does it have to say 10 and not 9? Well, I wouldn't think it would be 9. Why does it say 10 and not 11? Because the truth is that it's very possible to think that there's really 11. Why? Because if you were to count all the sefirot, including dot, you would get 11.
Oh, so you don't count them.
No. What you do is, if you count dot, you don't count crown. And if you count crown, you don't count dot. Meaning that dot is the lower manifestation of the crown.
Okay.
Because dot is the realization. It's the will processed through the wisdom and the understanding. It's like this. I want something. Now, what do I want? What do I want? I don't know. I want something. I want security. Ah, so I got it down to chachma. But now I say, well, security. What's that? What's security? So security is a warm pussycat. Nah. That's not security. That's not security. Okay, let's try again. All right, security is a blanket. No, that's not security. Security is a car. Uh-uh, that's not it. That's not what I want. Well, security is a...
teddy bear.
No, that's not it. Security is a house. Ah, that's it. Ah, that's what I want. Now, the last, that's what I want, is dot. Because when the two match, boom, you get this whole new realization and you have a much more tangible will. So therefore, the truth is that will and dot is only the lower manifestation of will, of Keter. And therefore, they're not counted twice because they're really only lower manifestation of each other. Now, what happens at the dot level is in mystical symbolism, you have water and fire.
Which one goes on which side?
I just did it. No, okay. I did it. In other words, dot is one but two. Okay, dot is one but two. Because it is one faculty which incorporates two completely opposite forces. A force of water, a force of fire. Dot, being at the very top of the spine, right, and is very often represented as the spine itself. Because it's where all the intellectual comes together and is converted into, I guess, you know, some kind of pulses that go through, impulse that goes through the spine, through the nervous system, directing the emotions, which then further direct the actions.
How do you say, do you know what's his spine name?
Shidra.
Shidra?
Yeah, Shidra.
Oh, okay.
Amud HaShidra. All right. Now, what is all this all about? Well, this is the tefillin. The tefillin is a crown on your head with four compartments. The crown being the root, the will, has included within it the potential of right brain wisdom, left brain understanding, and the two in the middle is dot. But why is dot represented in two? Because it incorporates two completely different forces. And there's a hint on the shin, because on one side you have three-pronged shin, the other side you have a four-pronged shin, which is really a weird thing to do. Why do you have four prongs? There are four prongs on the shin. But on this one there's only three. Because it's suggesting that the three become the four. Or the four becomes the three. Okay? Meaning, within the will is the potential for the whole process. And therefore, hinted in the will, which is now the crown, these four compartments is the potential of the wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. Then what happened? What comes out of the crown? Well, you have the right strap, which is then the right strap, which is then wisdom. You have left strap, which is understanding. And of course, where do they meet? In the Dalet, for dot. Right? For knowledge. Now remember, knowledge in Judaism isn't information. Who wants information? Right? Boring. Knowledge is an intimate connection in a way that moves you in what you want. Knowledge is the word used for, and man knew his wife. Wink, wink, say no more, right? We know what that means. The word knowledge is the most intimate relationship with something or someone. So this is that. You see what's going on over here? These ancient-looking tefillin actually represent a system. Right? And what is that system? What then comes out of knowledge? Right? What then comes out of knowledge? You have, let me get them. You have two very different straps. You have a right strap, and you have a left strap. And this is the energy forces moving through your body, right? And of course, we want to reach balance because we're plugging ourselves into the context of the talit as our unique selves will then get the direction and the proper balance, right, of how we then serve in the world. Now, what are these two straps? Well, as we mentioned before, there is water and there is fire. Water is the unitive force in the world. There's a unitive force in the world. And that's water. Water is always that which expresses unity.
Why does water correspond to chachma?
We'll deal with that later. Water expresses unity. Water takes the form of whatever you put it in because water has no sense of boundaries. And therefore, it doesn't make a difference to water. Whatever boundaries it takes. Water, you can't cut water to a certain extent. It's like, just the nature of water is to bring things together. The nature of fire disintegrates things. Right? I mean, water dissolves things, but they dissolve into each other. Right, into a homogenized whatever, right? But fire doesn't do that. Fire disintegrates things into little pieces, little cinders. So fire is the force of separation and distinction, borders. Water is the force of extension, and fire is the force of holding back constriction. Right? When you put something in fire, what happens? It crumples up, right? So things move in with fire, and things extend with water. Now, all movement in life is based on the unification of these two forces, right? Because when my hand is moving right now in the air, it is really the ability to unify two completely different forces. What are those forces? The force to extend and the force to hold back. Because if I only had the extension force, where would my hand be? But if I only had the holding back force, then where would my hand be? Right? The fact that I can move my hand is because I am able. It's brilliant. I mean, how can you do this? I call it God because I have no other words in science. I mean, what is that wisdom that enabled me to do this? I can do this. Right? And it's because I want to. I want to go up. Now I want to go down. I want to go over here. Now I want to go over there. It's unbelievable. It works. Right? So too, you have the right strap that is longer than the left strap. Why is the right strap longer than the left strap? Because what is the right strap? The force of extension. the water. And what is the left strap? The force of holding back, constriction, fire, and therefore it's shorter. Now that's how balance is in life, right? There's centripetal force and centrifugal force. There's outward, there's inward. There's extrovert, there's introvert. So, what's going on over here is putting on my tefillin is out of the concern to attune my mind, my intellectual process towards the emotional actual process with the structure of reality.
What?
One more time. By putting on the tefillin, what I'm doing is attuning my particular process, right, which is the intellectual, emotional, actual process, with the universal process. In a general sense, the mitzvot, the do's and the don'ts, is the precise balance of the dance of life. Because the do's is the water, how much you do, assert, express, and the don'ts is how much you have to hold back. That's the secret of life. The secret of life is knowing how much yes and how much no. Right? How much do you extend and how much do you hold back? How extroverted or how introverted should you be? Therefore, the tefillin is not really just suggesting. We believe it's much deeper than that. We believe that in a metaphysical way, the tefillin help us plug into the context, create the kind of balanced process in our own beings within the context of the talit, which is within the context of our service to God and our connection and ties to the divine source.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.